All right, so have you ever ever really thought about like whether a lawyer can be held responsible for something, to someone who isn't even their client?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, isn't it? And it might seem a little strange at first, right? Because we typically associate legal duties with that direct attorney-client relationship.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like you'd think your obligations are to the person paying you, right? But things aren't always so simple, are they?
Yeah.
Especially in the world of, corporate law and big transactions.
Right, you hit the nail on the head there. And that's precisely what makes this deep dive so fascinating. We're going to unpack a landmark case from the New York Court of Appeals, Prudential Insurance versus Dewey Ballantyne.
Oh, this is a big one for sure. I mean, any law student, even remotely interested in transactional work, you have to know Prudential v. Dewey.
Absolutely. This case set some really important precedents about when a law firm might owe a duty of care, not to their client, but to a third party. It really expanded the traditional view of legal responsibility.
Right. And it gets even more interesting because even though the court said that a duty could exist in this type of situation, they ultimately ruled that in this specific case, there was no breach of that duty.
That's the part that really makes you think, doesn't it? How can a duty exist but not be breached? There's definitely some nuance there.
So much nuance. I think it'll be super helpful for our listeners to understand this case inside and out, to really see how the court arrived at this, kind of seemingly contradictory conclusion.
Agreed. And I think in doing so, we'll all gain valuable insights into the potential responsibilities and liabilities that can arise when dealing with third parties, especially, for those of us working on complex transactions.
All right, so let's dive into the specifics of this case, shall we? We're going back in time to 1986. Picture this. US Lines, a major shipping company, they're in some serious financial trouble.
Right, they were really struggling, and Prudential Insurance comes into the picture with a plan to restructure a significant portion of U.S. Lines' debt.
And we're not talking small change here. This debt was a massive $92,885,000. To secure this loan, Prudential got a first preferred fleet mortgage on a bunch of US Lines ships.
Exactly, and Prudential, understandably, wanted to make sure that everything was legally sound with this deal, right? They needed assurance that their investment was protected.
Makes perfect sense. So, where do the lawyers come in?
Well, U.S. Lines had their own legal team, a firm called Gilmartin, Poster & Chaffetz. Prudential, being the prudent folks they are, requested an opinion letter from Gilmartin. Basically, they wanted Gilmartin to weigh in on the legality and enforceability of all these mortgage documents.
Got it. And opinion letters, those are pretty standard in these sorts of transactions, right? Like a way for one party to get some legal reassurance from the other side's lawyer.
Absolutely. So Gilmartin drafts this opinion letter, addresses it directly to Prudential, and states pretty clearly that the mortgage documents are legal, valid, and binding obligations of U.S. Lines.
Okay, so far so good, right? Seems pretty straightforward, but I have a feeling there's a twist coming.
You got it. There's a big one. It turns out that one of the recorded mortgage documents had a huge mistake. Instead of listing the debt as $92,885,000, it just said $92,885.
Wait, what? They missed a few zeros there. That's not just a typo. That's a $1 million mistake, literally.
You said it. And this seemingly small error, a misplaced comma, essentially, had massive consequences. Not too long after, U.S. Lines ended up filing for bankruptcy.
Oh no, I see where this is going.
Yep. When U.S. Lines went bankrupt, the issue with the mortgage amount surfaced, and Prudential was suddenly facing a massive loss. Remember, their security interest was based on that flawed document.
Ouch. So that little typo cost them big time. What did Prudential do?
Well, they weren't going to take this lying down. They sued Gilmartin for negligence. Their argument was that even though Gilmartin wasn't their lawyer, the firm still owed them a duty of care in this situation.
Right, because of that opinion letter. I mean, Prudential was relying on that, right?
Precisely. Now, this case had a bit of a journey through the court system. The trial court initially sided with Gilmartin, granting them summary judgment, saying there wasn't even enough of a case for a trial.
Wow, so the lower courts didn't see it Prudential's way.
Nope, not at first. The appellate division also upheld that summary judgment. But Prudential was persistent and decided to appeal to the highest court in New York, the Court of Appeals.
And that's where things get really interesting, legally speaking, right? I mean, the Court of Appeals had to grapple with some big questions.
Absolutely. This wasn't a simple case of straightforward attorney-client duty. They had to figure out, did Gilmartin, who represented U.S. Lines, owe a duty of care to Prudential, a non-client? And if they did owe a duty, did they breach that duty with that opinion letter?
Right. So how did the court even approach this? I mean, it's not like there's a simple rule book for figuring out when a lawyer is responsible to someone they don't even represent.
That's the thing, isn't it? There aren't always clear-cut answers in the law. But the court in Prudential v. Dewey used a really important legal test. It's called the credit alliance test.
Credit alliance. Okay, so to be honest, when I first heard about this case, I was like, wait, isn't that a test for accountants?
You are absolutely right. It was actually developed in cases about accountant liability, not lawyers. But the court decided that the principles of the credit alliance test could be applied here, too. It made sense in this context.
I guess when you're talking about professional duties and reliance, the logic can kind of transfer, right? So break it down for us. What are the main parts of the credit alliance test?
Okay, so the credit alliance test has three key elements. The first is awareness. In this case, it means Gilmartin had to be aware that Prudential was going to use their opinion letter for a very specific purpose, and that purpose was, you know, deciding whether or not to go through with this huge debt restructuring.
So it's not enough that, you know, Gilmartin might have had some vague idea that Prudential might see the letter. It's like they had to know that Prudential would rely on it, right?
Right. There had to be a very clear understanding that their opinion would directly influence Prudential's decision making. The second part of the test is reliance. This means Prudential actually had to rely on the opinion letter when they decided to go ahead with the restructuring. It can't just be, oh, we saw the letter, but we didn't really care what it said.
Makes sense. You have to actually take action based on the professional advice you're given. Yeah. So what's the third part? I feel like this one is a bit trickier, right?
Yeah, the third element is often the most nuanced. It's called linking conduct. Mm-hmm. This means there had to be something that Gilmartin did, some action they took, that directly connected them to Prudential and showed that they understood Prudential would be relying on their opinion.
Okay, so it's more than just sending the letter. I remember reading that the court used a phrase like, so close as to approach previty or something like that. What did they mean by that?
You've got a good memory.
Yeah.
Yeah, they used that exact phrase. Mm. What the court was getting at is they weren't trying to open the floodgates and say that any third party who happens to see a lawyer's work can sue for negligence. The so close as to approach privity idea emphasizes that the relationship between the lawyer and the non-client has to be almost as direct and strong as if they actually had a lawyer-client contract.
So it's like a heightened standard because you don't have that traditional attorney-client relationship. But in this case, with the letter being sent directly to Prudential and Gilmartin knowing how they would use it, that was enough to establish that almost privity-like connection.
Exactly. You nailed it. Now, using that credit alliance test, what do you think the court concluded? Did Gilmartin owe a duty to Prudential?
Well, based on everything we've discussed, it seems like they did, right? They knew Prudential would rely on the letter. Prudential did rely on it. And by sending the letter directly to them, they basically created that direct link.
You are absolutely right. The court found that all three parts of the credit alliance test were met. So yes, Gilmartin did owe a duty of care to Prudential, even though Prudential wasn't their client.
Okay, so that's a big deal. It means lawyers can have responsibilities that extend beyond their immediate clients, particularly in these types of transactions.
Exactly. But as we mentioned earlier, the story doesn't end there. Even though a duty was established, the court said Gilmartin didn't breach that duty. And this is where it gets a bit head-scratching, right? Because we know there was that million-dollar error.
Right. So how did the court square that circle? How could they say there was a duty but no breach?
The answer lies in the specific language and scope of Gilmartin's opinion letter. The court focused very carefully on what it said and what it didn't say. Remember, the letter basically stated that the documents were legal, valid, and binding, and that they were enforceable in accordance with their respective terms.
Okay, so they were saying the documents themselves were good from a legal standpoint, assuming the information in them was correct.
Precisely. And importantly, Gilmartin's opinion letter didn't guarantee the accuracy of things like the exact dollar amount of the debt. They made it very clear that they relied on certificates from their client, U.S. Lines, for those specific factual details.
Oh, so they kind of drew a line in the sand like, hey, we're lawyers, not auditors. We're vouching for the legal structure, not every number our client gives us.
Exactly. And there's a really important quote from the court's decision that helps clarify this. They said, neither procedural nor substantive misrepresentations were made. What does that tell you?
It sounds like they're saying Gilmartin didn't misrepresent how the documents were created or filed, and they didn't misrepresent the legal effect of the agreements themselves.
Spot on. That's exactly it. The error with the dollar amount, that was a factual mistake in the document itself, and the court decided that Gilmartin's opinion wasn't a guarantee against that kind of clerical error, especially when they had specifically said they were relying on their client's information for those details.
This makes me wonder, though, what if things had been a little different? Like, what if Gilmartin had specifically included the $92 million figure in their opinion letter? Would that have changed things?
Ah, that's a brilliant question. And, it gets to the heart of the issue. If Gilmartin had said something like, "We've checked the mortgage documents and confirmed they secure a debt of $92,885,000, without any qualification that they were relying on their client's numbers, then yes, the outcome likely would have been different.
Because then it wouldn't just be about the enforceability of the agreement, it would be about the accuracy of that specific number, right?
Exactly. By stating that number as a fact, seemingly verified by them, that would have been a direct representation about his accuracy. The fact that they didn't do that they kept their opinion focused on the legal framework and clearly stated their reliance on their client for the numbers, that was crucial to the court finding no breach.
Wow, so this case really highlights the importance of precise language, especially in these opinion letters. Like, every word matters. What are some takeaways from Prudential v. Dewey for, future lawyers out there who are going to be drafting these types of documents?
Oh, tons of takeaways. First and foremost, this case screams caution. It emphasizes the need for extreme care when drafting anything that a non-client might rely on. You need to be incredibly precise with your language and clearly state the scope of your opinion.
So it's not enough to just use the same old boilerplate language for every opinion letter.
Definitely not. You need to really think about what you're actually vouching for legally. Are you confirming the factual details, or are you relying on your client's representations for those? If it's the latter, you need to spell that out very clearly in the letter. Include those disclaimers and qualifications, like, we're relying on X, Y, and Z provided by our client.
I'm starting to see how this all ties back to that so close as to approach privity idea, right? The more specific and limited your opinion is, the less likely it is that you're creating that really direct connection with the non-client.
Exactly. You're drawing clearer boundaries around your professional responsibility. This case shows that lawyers can be held accountable to non-clients, so being super careful with your wording is essential to managing that potential liability.
Right. So even though the court found a duty in Prudential v. Dewey, they spent a lot of time explaining why that duty wasn't actually breached. Why is it so important to understand that distinction that a duty can exist without being breached?
Because it highlights that having a duty is just step one in a negligence claim. Even if a lawyer is found to owe a duty to a non-client, like in this case, the person suing still has to prove that the lawyer messed up, that they acted below the standard of care for the profession, and that that directly caused harm.
So, in Prudential, Gilmartin owed a duty, but because their opinion was limited in scope and they didn't make any false statements about the legal stuff they were opining on, there was no breach.
Exactly. Now, let's shift gears a bit and talk about the purpose of these opinion letters. What's their main function in these big transactions?
I mean, it's kind of in the name, right? They're meant to give an opinion a legal perspective.
True. But the court in Prudential recognized that the main goal of these letters in a transactional setting is to assure the other side the deal is legally sound. They're checking if the corporate stuff is done right, if the documents are legal, and if the terms can be enforced.
So they're not really meant to be a deep dive, like an audit of all the facts and figures?
Not usually, no. It's more about the legal framework than the nitty-gritty details of the deal itself.
Got it. Now, one last thought about the credit alliance test itself. It feels like it's trying to find a balance, right? Protect third parties who are relying on these opinions, but also protect lawyers from being sued for every little thing.
You're picking up on a key theme here. The credit alliance test is all about balance. It's about creating a situation where lawyers are held responsible when there's a clear understanding that someone's relying on their work and a direct connection between their actions and that reliance. But by setting those specific requirements, the test also prevents lawyers from being liable for every single person who might be indirectly affected by their work.
It's all about defining that zone of responsibility, right? So to sum up our deep dive today, under the credit alliance test, lawyers can definitely owe a duty of care to non-clients when they know those folks are going to rely on their work. But proving a breach of duty, that's a whole other ballgame. It requires more than just a mistake in the underlying facts. It requires showing that the lawyer made specific misrepresentations about the legal stuff they were supposed to be addressing.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And as we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners, all you aspiring legal eagles, with a final thought. The world of transactions is only getting more complex, right? With technology and global deals, the potential for errors, whether it's human error or even, you know, a computer glitch, it's always there.
So how do we, as future lawyers, navigate these potential duties to non-clients? How do we make sure our work is both effective and protects us from these liabilities?
These are the questions you should be asking yourselves as you move forward in your legal careers. Cases like Prudential v. Dewey, they give us a framework, they show us the potential pitfalls, and they remind us that legal ethics and professional responsibility, these aren't just abstract concepts, they have real-world consequences. So stay curious, keep learning, and never underestimate the power of clear, precise legal writing.
Couldn't agree more. Until next time.
See you then.